One mistake I keep revolting against is the mistake of premature internationalization. What I've seen over the last 7 years happen quite often is that people building marketplaces that had quite a strong local component were actually planning on internationalization way too early. Usually, frankly, advised by investors saying, hey, why are you not in a different country? You should go in another country because it's people building stuff in that other country. While they're still very early in their own journey and actually haven't quite figured out their home market.
Welcome to Two Sided, the marketplace podcast, brought to you by ShareTribe.
Hello and welcome. I am Stuart, CMO at ShareTribe, and I am your host. Welcome to episode number 5 of season 3 of Two Sided, where, once again, a reminder, this season we interview marketplace investors to see what they are looking for, what they are seeing in the market, and also where they think the future is going. And this is perhaps a good bridge to my guest of today, because I'm talking today to Jeroen Arts of Speed Invest. And I'm saying this is a good bridge because, as you'll hear in the interview, Jeroen gives a great caveat to his advice, and I think maybe something that we could take as caveat for this entire season, namely, VCs are terrible predictors of the future. Those are his words, not mine, and they might be a bit rough, but let's say that they're not that much better than the average person. Of course, the difference is, and why we're talking to them, is that they have a lot more data. So, for example, Speed Invest sees, I think Jeroen says, thousands of ideas and slide decks per year. So, you know, they do have a lot more things that they can take into account when they start predicting the future. Maybe something else about this episode, more so than in previous episodes, that we talk a lot about founders. So Jeroen, first of all, has been a founder himself of a marketplace called Deskbookers. But by now, he also has many years of experience in investing and working with portfolio companies and founders. And so throughout the conversation, he mentioned some of the qualities that he started to appreciate and some of the good decisions or good patterns that he's seen, and also maybe some of the patterns that are less successful. So for example, one thing that I really liked is what he called the clock speed in founders. And this is something that he has started to appreciate over the last couple of years. So the power of speed in decision making, how quickly can founders make decisions and adapt to change in the early days? Another thing is why market focus is more important than premature internationalization. So Jeroen, I think, also mentioned that this is sometimes driven a little bit by an investor push, but trying to scale too quickly into multiple regions can really backfire for many early stage marketplace founders. Finally, one last point is about certain trends driving marketplace innovation. So Jeroen's quite excited about certain opportunities and some things that I didn't really know about. Well, for example, he mentioned health as an industry. But also, you know, sort of a macroeconomic thing, namely new consumer behavior that Gen Z is having, where he sees massive opportunity. All in all, I think an episode full of practical advice, really, really useful for founders. I had a great time talking to Jeroen. Maybe actually quick disclaimer that, we're both Dutch from the Netherlands originally. Both also have a name that is pretty much impossible to pronounce in any other language. But, you know, be prepared, there might be some Dutch accent twang going on, although I do think we did pretty well. But like I said, I really enjoyed this episode. I hope you will enjoy this episode too. Lots of practical advice for founders. So let's go. Here is my conversation with Jeroen Arts of Speed Invest. Hi, Jeroen. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, really nice of you to make the time to be here. I know you just told me before we start recording, end of year, loads of things to do, existing portfolio work, new deals, hitting the quarterly goals. Before we go into all of that, could you tell the audience a little bit about what did you do before you became a marketplace investor?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm Jeroen. I'm originally from the Netherlands. It's also a name that only works in the Netherlands somehow, so it makes it quite complicated to work in a very international setting.
Say no more.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I started into the marketplace space roughly 12 years ago. I had like quite a traditional upbringing and studied international economics. I was done then kind of like on the verge of, okay, what am I going to do after this university? I think most of my colleagues actually went into the usual, right? They went for like a government role, or they went for consulting. Some went down to the research part. I tried to explore the research part a little bit, but I realized, okay, that's a very boring thing, so I don't want to do that. I actually found my way working in sports, in track and field. So I was an international athletes representative, basically working with
Olympic
level athletes. So it was actually pretty cool because at the end of the day, we were scouting for talent and then trying to support them throughout their career. And in a way, there's some similarities with the work that we're doing today. At least
I
used to believe that there's some similarity there. So at the same time, during that time, together with one of my best friends, I started a company called Deskbookers, which was ultimately a SaaS-enabled marketplace where you could rent work and meeting spaces on an hourly basis. So I think the main thesis behind it was we saw a future where people would actually not always work from the same place, but actually people would have the option to choose whether they want to work from the office, whether they want to work from home, or they want to work from a third-party workplace. And with that marketplace, we were actually offering that third-party workplace solution. So good idea, difficult business, and proved to be very, very hard to scale. But yeah, that was back in 2012, approximately when we started that. We also raised some money for that later on. So that was kind of my way into the venture scene.
Yeah, all right. I didn't know that. I mean, we met a couple of times, just a disclaimer for the listener. I mean, the Deskbooker, first of all, I think that's an interesting idea. And also a little bit like, it feels like ahead of the curve, kind of like coming. Of course, there were some things, but I think that loads of these things we've especially seen like after the COVID or during the COVID thing, that the remotes more. It's interesting. Maybe that's the straight, I'm going to use the Olympic thing as a sort of set up for my next question. How do you evaluate marketplaces? And I think that for a lot of investors, like the founder or the team is an important component, and maybe taking that sort of like high performance, like kind of obsessiveness that you need as an Olympic athlete as well as a founder. So maybe you can talk a little bit about, first of all, of course, I'd like to get eventually the answer about how do you evaluate marketplaces, etc. But maybe first we can start on a founder level. Like what are you looking for?
Yeah. So maybe for just to make the full picture of where I'm today. So I obviously work now for
for
Speed Invest. We're like early stage pan-European pre-seed and seed fund. And then within Speed Invest, we actually have different investment teams that focus on particular verticals. And then I'm responsible for our marketplace and consumer team. So basically everything I do on a day-to-day basis is investing in marketplace and consumer businesses. And I've been doing that over the past 7 years. I joined late 2017 when we started to build these specialized investment teams. So, you know, I think there's some interesting parallels between kind of like work in sports and work in venture, from the sense that at the end of the day, it's a people's business, right? So whether you work with a professional athlete or whether you work with a company as an investor, I think there's ultimately people that are working every day very hard to build a successful business. So especially also for us, given that we're a pre-seed and seed investor, we also lean in very, very early. And sometimes there's actual revenue, but in many cases, there's no revenue yet. So it's kind of like pre-traction. In some cases, it's kind of pre-product. In some cases, pretty much pre-everything. And it's basically just a team, right? So that's also why for me as an investor, the number one, two, and three reason I want to invest in a company are always around the team, right? I think...
Yeah.
You know, there's obviously a lot of things that you want to see in those kind of founder qualities. But I think one that I start to appreciate much more, I think over the past 12 to 24 months, is simply kind of the clock speed that a founder brings to the business. So their kind of their ability to make decisions and to move forward. I think that's a really good indicator for how this pod as a portfolio company will go moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. So like, do you mean like clock speed, just like sort of the time they make to, you know, their ability to make decisions fast and like with whatever information is available? Because of course, you know, information is always incomplete, especially in a startup level.
Totally.
Ah, that's interesting. Yeah. I haven't heard of that one before.
Yeah. I think that's a really underappreciated quality. And, you know, the reality of course is when we make an investment, we always have the belief that this will be a unicorn, right? I mean, that's we're investing in venture, right? So we believe in the power law. Power law is what drives our ultimate performance. And so we always believe that this can be like an outlier company when we invest. At the same time, when it doesn't work out that way, you always start to look, okay, what are the main reasons for it not working out? And I think in some cases, it can be market, right? You might be simply too early in the market, or the offering wasn't clear enough for people to really understand it, or the time was not quite there to be. At the same time, I think most companies fail because of ultimately poor execution, right? And then ultimately execution starts at the founder level. So ideally you want to have founders that kind of like, you know, have the determination but also the willingness to make kind of like bold bets early on in the journey of a startup and simply not overthink every decision, because you usually don't really have the time, right? I think the biggest constraint you have as a founder is simply time and resources, or cash basically. And within the time frame that you're given, you need to make a ton of decisions and you want to move very quickly. I think that's a very important quality I see in the successful cases.
I can totally I now when you mention it makes a lot of sense. Like you said, like as a startup, basically, I think also internally at ShareTrip we've used in the past, it's better now, but like there have been times in the past where it's like essentially we're just dying, like, and it's just about like the runway. If you look at the runway at a startup, which is a sort of common framework for startups to estimate their lifetime between funding rounds, especially that like you're 24 months away from dying, so you cannot actually overthink things. Makes a lot of sense. Coming back to some of these things that you said, so you mentioned that you work at Speed Invest in these sort of verticals. Is a marketplace truly a vertical? Mm-hmm. Is it is it a marketplace model? Is that an actual horizontal in itself? And also when you said about, you know, sometimes an idea is too close to a market. So my question is going to be like, are there any markets right now that you feel, or maybe like already, maybe we're jumping a little bit ahead, but I this is a natural connection for me. Like, are there any markets that you see opportunity in that you get excited if you get a deck and you know it's going to be in a particular space, or you're like, yeah, I've been waiting for this, or we can see this?
Yeah. I mean, I think the caveat is, I think VCs are terrible predictors of the future, right? So it's not like we have like this crystal ball and we know exactly how the world kind of like will look like in 5 years. The beauty, of course, of the work that we do is that we are very close to innovation, but we're still a little bit of like a lagging, we're a little bit lagging on what's actually happening, right? Because the founders are out there, they're trying to build new things, and on us to really evaluate, okay, is this something that we are keen on, and is this something that's kind of like hot and happening? So we're always a little bit late to the game, but there's definitely a couple of areas that we're particularly excited about, right? So I think the one area where I'm kind of like trying to lean in, and I would worry it's not going to be pure AI, right? I think there's a lot of opportunity around AI, but I think the one thing I find particularly interesting is the generational shift that we're seeing, where now the younger consumer, let's say Gen Z, so everybody who is like roughly between 15 and early 20s, that generation becomes way more important now as they mature, right? They have more money to spend. So to become a more important share of the wallet these days. What we see is that the way this segment is actually transacting is very different to previous generations, right? Previous generations, my generation, my parents' generation, they're not digitally native. We don't really look for a lot of like social evidence before we decide on a purchase. But this young generation is like fully digitally native, right? They've been growing up online. They're looking at what their friends are buying. Also very open in sharing about what the best things are that they like. So they're very strong advocates typically for the stuff that they buy. And I think what's really interesting is that both on the consumer side, of course, they become more important as they mature and actually start to earn money, but also they make their way to the work floor. So this will also, I think, drive a lot of innovation, not just on the B2C side, but actually also on the B2B side, where let's say the traditional 50 plus year entrepreneur is slowly moving out of the organization and will actually be replaced with younger managers who are actually way more digitally affluent. Yeah? So I think that's a really interesting shift that we're seeing. I think there's probably a lot of innovation being built around that.
Yeah, so should I then think about, for example, because this is like, I'm 43, I'm not digitally native, but you know, like there are times where I feel old, times where I feel young. When I feel old is when I see things, for example, like What's Not, like this marketplace, or is this social selling where someone is like live selling a thing. So is that one of the things you were talking about, that like, for example, we're going to see like B2B, you know, industrial material sales through a YouTube channel or something? Like, I mean, I'm obviously oversimplifying it here and exaggerating a bit, but that's the kind of things you're talking
about? Well, I'm obviously not ruling it out. I mean, and I'm also like 40, right? So I look at these videos and I cringe, right? I'm like, oh God, would I be willing to do that? But the younger generation is just broadcasting basically the whole day, you know? Yeah. And so it's a very different way how they, what their kind of their stances in the world and how they transact. So I think that brings innovation. And from that innovation, we will see new startups actually building something that seems more appealing to this younger generation. I think, so that's like one big theme that I think is really interesting to explore, and which we're also trying to actively invest in at Speed Invest.
Yeah. Taking a couple steps back. So you said earlier when we talked about like, did you look at the team and you mentioned that, of course, that you're so early sometimes with Speed Invest that there is not a lot of indicators. So what do you look for then? You already described the team, but then how do you evaluate the actual business idea? How do you, what are the success metrics that you're looking at or the kind of potential metrics like for a marketplace?
The answer would always be, it depends, right? So it depends a little bit on where the stage is at. They have a product in the market, then there's obviously some transactions to look at, and then from those transactions, you can kind of derive, okay, is this a marketplace that seems to be working? The beauty of a marketplace business is that it's essentially very simple, right? You bring supply and demand together, and if you're able to facilitate transactions between them, at least you have a kernel of something, right? There's a basis to build on. It doesn't necessarily mean that you can build like a big business out of it, but at least it seems that you have some sort of problem solution fit. And then the question becomes more, how can we get from this problem solution fit to product market fit? Well, where product market fit is much more around, okay, can we actually acquire customers at scale at an affordable price? Are they staying with us? Do we see that there's strong retention in the product? And are the unit economics of the transaction that we're doing, are those like profitable, or is that these a part of profitability? So the way how we assess a business really depends, I think, on what stage it actually is. And we probably have a bit of a split of 30 to 40% companies being very, very early. Frankly, founders have pre-product. Yeah, pre-product. Maybe they've built some sort of MVP. They're already able to articulate kind of what they want to build. That might change, you know, because it's so early, right? So it would not be unusual to see a pivot there. Then there's probably another third or so that is somewhat like very early. So there's some early evidence, there's some early metrics that you can maybe look at. And then the other 30% or third, I would roughly classify as more like late seed, especially like when we go a little bit more into consumer territory, we try to look a little bit more deeply into the marketplace to see what transactions are happening. You have a bit of a pattern because you have maybe, I don't know, 6 to 12 months of data. And there it's much more like, okay, is this going to work or not, right? So it really depends on what stage we're investing in. My personal philosophy, I think, would be maybe interesting to share is, in industries where I see already a lot of companies being built, I prefer to be a little bit later because it's just very hard to pick a winner in that kind of space.
Yeah.
However, if it's more like a blue ocean kind of opportunity, and you see there's a lot of things in different B2B sectors where there's frankly still a lot of room for new marketplaces to pop up, I'm very happy and very comfortable in actually investing pretty much pre-everything. Yeah? So that's a very simple framework I personally use.
Yeah. Yeah. Could you give an example, if possible, of like an industry where you feel like, okay, this is still, or like, I don't know, it's not maybe one particular industry, but let's say somewhere in the matrix where there is still a blue chip, like where you're like, you know, maybe using an example that you can share that's like not too recent, but reason enough that you're comfortable sharing it. That's like, okay, here, of course, you do the due diligence, you meet the team, etc. But then you're like, okay, I had a good feeling about this one from the beginning because of like, I see the opportunity.
Yeah, I think the one thing I would say is that it keeps surprising me even after 7 years and probably, I mean, we see roughly 2,000 companies a year, right? So let's say over those 7 years, we had a bit of a growth on the deal flow side as well, but we probably have assessed north of 10,000 companies just in marketplaces and consumer, right? So we see a lot.
Yeah.
And still I get to be surprised many times when I figure out, hey, there's an interesting new marketplace developing, right? I think the beauty of a marketplace is typically it also kind of like creates a whole new economic system. Every year there's a number of deals that I see. I'm like, hey, wow, I would never have imagined a marketplace here. I think one investment that we recently did is in a company called Row Club. And Row Club stands for Remote Operator Club.
Okay.
And I think it's a good example because it's actually in the health space. And health is quite a regulated business typically. So that's where typically still a lot of like blue ocean is for people to build something. And because it's, you know, it's a bit of a hairy topic. People don't necessarily want to do all the hard work to build something in a highly regulated business. And this team is basically building, I would say, a SaaS-enabled marketplace where they allow technicians to operate MRI machines remotely. So if you're familiar with like an MRI machine, you ever went to an MRI machine?
Yeah.
You always see
that. Yeah, I played football. I've torn my ACL, so I've been there. Yeah.
Yeah. You typically need a number of people kind of like in the room or close by that actually operate the machines.
Yeah.
You need to have these people on site, right? And there's this this one-on-one relationship between a technician on site and the machine that being operated. What RoClub does, RoClub stands for Remote Operator Club. They actually built like a hardware in combination with software that allows clinics to operate these MRI machines remotely. So no longer you need to have someone in the room. You actually just connect to the RoClub platform and you're able to operate this machine purely remote. And what then RoClub does is that on top of this, let's say, hardware and software stack, they actually build like a marketplace where you can hire those technicians on a very flexible basis, right? So I would have never envisioned this myself.
No.
This just happened to fall onto our desk and we kind of like fell in love with it. And it's one of those examples where if you go to many like regulated businesses like healthcare, like law, like et cetera, I think there's still a lot of room for people to come up with very creative ways how marketplaces could be beneficial to build something of value. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I mean, I fully echo that sentiment, right? Like, I try not to put too much Chatrip in each episode, but I think it's Chatrip as well. Like, we have now like 1,200 plus customers like live, but we've had thousands over the years. And indeed, there's still like ideas. There's ideas that are like, oh, I've seen that. But then also, like, also surprisingly regularly, like, wow, I did not think that this would work, or I had no idea that that market was so big, for example. Yeah. But yeah, that's a fantastic example. And I guess also like from an investor point of view, yeah, some of these industries or areas are like less, you know, less appealing because of the regulation. But to me, that immediately sort of echoed back. It's like, well, that's also kind of an additional moat, right? Like that is, it will be also less likely to be competed out of the market just because it's just not so attractive. Like,
yeah, I think like in the investor space, you can make sort of like contrarian bets a little bit. And the question is, it is like one of those contrarian bets. But I think especially if you look at where people are investing today, I think most of the money is going to AI and climate. Just if you look at the numbers, that's where the money goes, right? Yeah. However, that doesn't mean that there's not opportunity in all the other spaces, right? So
yeah,
you know, we have a benefit because as you mentioned before, we are not, our marketplace team is not quite a vertical, right? We're obviously much more horizontal, right? And we're just a business model, ultimately that we're focused on. So we get to see many different industries. We can therefore also pick very, very broadly, which we're also actively doing. It sometimes helps to not just follow the herd and invest in the next AI deal or the next climate deal, even though those also sectors that I think are like super interesting. We have different teams that are pursuing those kind of deals.
Yeah. What are some of the things where you're like, oh, this is we already talked about like, what are the green lights? Like what are the red flags where you're like, oh, I think this is not going to work? Or like, what is a mistake? Maybe this, I'm just trying to say in a very original way, like what are common mistakes that you see early stage marketplace founders make?
I think one mistake I keep revolting against is the mistake of like premature internationalization, which I think is very much a topic that's top of mind, or internationalization is very much a topic top of mind for marketplace founders, particularly in Europe, because we have such a fragmented piece of land here that is split up in all these different countries with all the different nuances. And what I've seen over the last 7 years happen quite often is that people building marketplaces that had quite a strong local component were actually planning on internationalization way too early. Usually, frankly, advised by investors saying, hey, why are you not in a different country? You should go in another country because there's people building stuff in that other country. While they're still very early in their own journey and actually haven't quite figured out their home market. This just really amplifies all the problems that you're already having because you're starting to spread your resources across different geos. You're only increasing the complexity of your organization that you're building. You're spending all your money now, not just in one market, but in two markets, all the while you really haven't figured out your first market, right? So I think it's bad for many reasons, but I think one particular reason that I think is also very bad about is if you think about potentially exiting a business, you also want to make sure that you actually are of value when someone tries to buy you. So if you have like a tiny little bit of penetration in one country and a tiny bit in one other country, you're just not a very meaningful business. So you ideally want to go very deep in one country, show that it really works, and actually from then start to go to another country. So I think that's one common pitfall I see, especially like first time founders make when they're poorly advised by investors. Mm-hmm. And I always have to chuckle a little bit about that one.
Yeah, just because, like, to be honest, like, that is not a surprise. Like, every, I think, like, now we've done two seasons of this podcast, it's going to be deferred. And I think every time when I do the sort of summary, that's like start small, like, honestly, like, whether that is like you give the geographical vector, but similarly for categories, right? Like, if you add on, if you start expanding your marketplace category, like, but I'm super happy that you say it, because, like, I really feel that, like, you know, if I would go out tomorrow, like, this would be the one advice, like, yeah, honestly, because, like, it is so important that like you said, like you haven't figured out all your problems, you haven't figured out your known unknowns, let alone your unknown unknowns. So it becomes like a compounding error over time, like, if you keep on adding either to one side or another. So
I've been a founder myself as well. So, and I think as a founder, you have to walk this tightrope between, on the one hand, having focus in your business, right? And I think you do that best by actually focusing on a niche, making sure that niche, whatever, that's a product category or a country or region, is
or both,
to kind of make that work. At the same time, from a, let's say, a fundraising point of view, and if you are to pursue like a venture game, you also need to show a big enough thumb, right? So you need to be able to pitch the big story while still focusing on the small story and getting that small story to work first, right? So it's also not necessarily very easy, but I think sometimes founders mix these two concepts up a little bit, and I think we have to show a big TAM, so we should go after that straight away. And I don't think that's always the right strategy. I mean, it might be for some businesses, but for many businesses, actually, it's not.
Yeah, and I think the geo also very much depends, of course, like, on the type of marketplace, right? Like, if you are some kind of local marketplace where both sides need to be in the same space, or the product and the buyer need to be in the same space, it's of course a different thing. But still, I think, like, indeed, like, it's good to hear, it's not good to hear. It's kind of sad to hear that this is still a problem. But this is really, I feel like, the number one problem for most marketplace, like, early stage marketplace entrepreneurs.
I think I want to say, like, founders are the real rock stars, right? So I think, you know, investors can do all fancy things, but it's really about the founders and kind of their ability to kind of like build the next big thing. And what I would encourage founders, though, because I see a lot of like very talented founders, but they end up, in my view, pursuing too small of an opportunity, right? They're fishing in a too small pond. It also makes sense if you are going to dedicate 60, 80 plus hours a week to this idea, and you committed yourself for the next 5 to 7 years, you want to make sure you commit yourself to solve the biggest problem. Of course, that biggest problem might be very personal. So it might be for you, this is the biggest problem I want to solve, and that's for where I want to do it. But I also see quite often great founders, in my view, pursuing a very small, not so interesting category. And I think that's of course, a very personal choice from the founder, and I totally respect that. But sometimes you're like, this founder would be so great if we would be starting a different business.
We've sort of already touched on some of the areas once, but maybe not so much in the industry, but have you seen interesting developments, let's say, in the marketplace model? So not so much like, oh, this is a interesting area or this is a thing, but like ways of monetizing, like, have you seen, you know, you said you've been 7 years looking at these, so anything that you feel like, okay, this is really this has been an interesting development, or a development that has sort of already concluded, but that is because I think a lot of the advice on the net out there is already outdated, right?
I think it's always hard to stay original, to be very honest, but I think if you take a step back and look at how have marketplaces developed as sort of like a business model over the past, I don't know, 20 plus years, right? Ever since kind of eBay and Amazon were founded in like 95, 97, somewhere around that time. And where we are today, I think we obviously saw a shift away from like purely horizontal to much more vertical. I think that's one very big transition that I think will actually also accelerate in the next year. And I'll tell you why. The level of involvement of the marketplace in making that transaction happen has gone from a very small role where initially there was like a listing and, you know, this is the listing, connect to each other, figure it out, to, hey, we're also going to handle the payment, we're going to handle logistics, we're going to handle insurance. So also the amount of value that the marketplace brings in order to make that transaction happen has increased quite dramatically. And you went from like highly unmanaged marketplace to very managed marketplace, right? So I think that will persist. And I think actually here AI is also going to be a bit of a driver, because the reality with AI is that this will, I think, allow founders to spin up more complex products and operate these kind of like platforms also while spending way less money than they did before, right? Because they can use AI to really automate a lot of the interactions. They can make the matching between supply and demand easier. You can create way better search to actually take away all the friction around making decision between, okay, what should I actually purchase from this marketplace? But also for a founder to build a company, also here you can see that AI will really be a big lever to drive down the cost of running that marketplace. So that in essence will make sure that founders will pursue, I think, even smaller verticals and probably also more complex products. So I see the path from like a horizontal unmanaged marketplace to a verticalized managed marketplace only kind of like continue. I think that's going to be quite interesting. Yeah. How that pans out.
Yeah, that makes sense. And do you feel that you would draw a graph like where on the one vector you have like sort of involvement in a transaction and then also sort of the amount that you can monetize on it, right? Like it would go sort of like perfectly 45 degrees up. Does it also sort of give rise that like coming to the venture-based outcome that the market doesn't actually need to be as big as you're just able to can get, like you can get a lot more revenue per transaction, right? So you need less market. Am I drawing that conclusion, or you think that is an oversimplification?
I think that might be right, but I'm also not 100% sure. I think in essence, I think the whole AI boom is already overlaying a lot of like interesting thought around, okay, how does the venture capital model, does it actually still work, right? Do companies actually still need also that much money in later stages? Are they not going to be profitable actually way earlier, right? So the way I think about that problem is much more around, okay, what does it mean for us as an early stage investor? Rather than can the outcome be smaller? For venture capital to work, we still need outlier returns. So we still want to have that 100x or that 50x and not that 3 or 4x because it's simply a very different model, right? So we will always shoot for these bigger outcomes. The question is, how can we get to those bigger outcomes and how much capital do some of our portfolio companies need to actually get to that level? And I think this is where it gets really interesting. And I don't have the answer here, but there's at least some concern from my side that maybe companies actually need way less money, which means that probably most funds will actually go a little bit earlier because they want to be part of the journey already early on. I mean, it's just very early thinking on that topic.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I think we see that also, you know, last time I'm going to insert Chartup in here, but like, I think that this is one of the, we just recently did this survey of all our customers who, like, how much funding did they use and, or how much funding were they able to raise? Because there's often this concern that like no code or sort of like hired services like ours are not venture compatible. And it was surprising, like, I think it was 66 million from the customers that they've raised together, but then when you sort of look through them, I think a lot of them actually have a little bit, I think maybe I'm projecting, but I feel are sort of echoing what you're saying. That like, well, they don't actually need that much because the tech is just a lot more affordable. They can show revenue early on, so they have a much better sort of negotiation at the table. There's also less risk for the venture capital fund because you have just more data to go by. So it makes a lot of sense what you're saying. Thanks a lot for the insights. If people would like to contact you, pitch to you, where should they go?
That's a very good question. Obviously, you can go to speedinvest.com. Where people can pitch directly on the website as well. They can, of course, reach me on LinkedIn, is where I'm most active. And what I didn't mention before, I'm also the host of the Marketplace Conference, like an annual conference that we do for Marketplace founders. So we would, of course, also love to see people there. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can totally recommend that. I've been there, I think, almost every year, maybe every year since it's been at least the Berlin edition. The San Francisco, I think, is the other one. Is usually a little bit too far out of my regular day, but 100%. Every time it is super useful for any marketplace founder. It's a fantastic conference, especially in Europe to go to, and I'd imagine the US one is the same. I think there's no other like it. I appreciate this too. Thanks a lot for your time, and until next time.
Thank you for listening to Two Sided, the Marketplace Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe. And if you really liked it, please give us a rating or a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. If you got inspired to build your own marketplace, go visit www.sharetribe.com. It's the fastest way to build a successful online marketplace business.